Disaster, a podcast about disasters and the music they make us listen to. I'm Peter, and I'm here with my co-host, Lee.
I'm Pete. No, I'm Lee, and I'm...
Keeping it. Powering through.
I'm here, and I'm Lee with my Peter co-host.
Great. And we're also here with our special guest, Nuclear Norm.
Guten Tag.
It's so good to be here at a table together.
It surely is.
For many reasons. For example, when it comes to editing, you're not dealing with three tracks that you're trying to align the timing of. God. Nightmare.
Wizardry.
And then we're also not dealing with our 30-minute Zoom limitation.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Because we're so cheap.
Oh, I got to throw the call over.
Right, yeah. No, we are going to simulate that, though. So after 30 minutes, we're just going to have to stop talking.
Okay.
And then just do, anyway.
Okay. And then I won't actually forget to hit record one time when we had a really brilliant intro.
Awkward. I think I salvaged it. Anyway, you're joining us for a disaster because that's the name of the podcast.
No way.
Right? Brought to you by Norm. And I think maybe I'll just do a little bit of intro. Actually, how are you guys doing?
Doing all right.
How many episodes have you done? Because obviously you've not released any by the time I'm here saying these words.
So far we've got two in the bag.
Two in the bag, mm-hmm. And many more in the
in the
hopper,
in the chute,
in the bag, the bag prep zone.
They'll be dumping out that chute any minute.
They come down the hopper into the bag,
yeah,
into the chute,
yep,
and then they get spit out into the world.
Yep, plop down into the internet.
Perfect.
I'm trying to make a poop analogy.
Gross.
Yeah.
I don't cotton to that kind of humor.
I mean, you're not the best at that, but...
liar.
You're not really the best at those analogies, but I think you're number two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. I think you guys both know this, but the other day, I was messing around with my son, like, joking around. Making poop jokes, because that's what he finds hilarious.
It's common.
So it was like, poop joke after poop joke after poop joke. And then eventually, he, like, his expression fell, and dead serious, he was like... Dad, not everything's about poop.
Congratulations.
Judas. And that's when he outgrew you.
Intellectually surpassed.
Oh, my God.
By a three-year-old.
Anyway, yeah. So we're here for a major disaster brought to you by Nuclear Norm. If you're new here, I recommend you start at the beginning and work your way all the way back to where we are now. Because then you'll be in the know. I don't know how many references Norm has to previous episodes. I'm a little bit behind on my episode references because it's been a while, but I'm sure we'll pull some in as well.
Yeah,
not. So if you want to be fully in the know, go back and listen to those. And if you get through all those and you like what you hear, tell somebody else to listen. That's the best thing that we can ask from you, of us, to you and friends. I'm just going to let Norm take over because I'm running out of words. And Norm, take it away. What are we talking about?
All right. So let's get into this.
Let's do it.
The Idaho National Lab. Guess where that's located?
America.
Yes, it is. So shockingly, it's located in Idaho Falls, Idaho.
Oh, I thought it was going to be like a what's the word for
like
when you have
those,
letters
that
represent something.
It's located in the place it's named after.
Words,
no,
sure
there's
are.
Just like a acronym. There we go.
Said it
the same time.
It's in Idaho.
Same time.
So it's a national, one of several national labs
hosted
by the United States Department of Energy.
Oh, sweet. Mm.
It was previously known as the National Reactor Testing Station.
Ooh. Are we going to be talking about piles again?
Yep. Nice. One of the most historically significant, actually, nuclear research facilities in the world. It housed over 50 experimental reactors over the years, including the world's first usable nuclear reactor.
Chicago Pile.
I mean, that was from Chicago. That wasn't usable.
Oh.
It just worked. This was like the first one that actually generated more than half a watt of energy.
Idaho Pile.
It was a real pile. Well, there's going to be some piles. So we all remember.
I hear that's painful.
We all remember January 3rd, 1961.
Of course. I was
negative 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, so taking yourself back to January 3rd, 1961, this is like, put yourself in this mind frame here. We're in the middle, ramping up into the deep stages of the Cold War.
Right. Okay. Sure. Can't picture it.
I mean, obviously.
What's conflict with Russia like?
Yeah.
Any recent analogies?
No, they're fairly.
Got to go back to the 80s for
as
this
a nation.
One.
Yeah, can't. Anyway.
Mm. Okay, so.
I'll try and think of one.
The Cuban Revolution had just occurred in Cuba, and that brought communism right to the doorsteps of America.
Right. Oh, boy.
We know you can't have that.
No.
And so in January, JFK was just about to take office, mm-hmm. and the tensions were rising.
Mm.
Yeah.
So at 9.01 p.m. on January 3rd, mm-hmm. the fire alarm at the National Reactor Testing Station goes off.
You don't want that.
Mm. You don't want those.
Of all the places you want fires.
somebody get that? Now.
So the when the firefighters arrived, they had no one there to greet them. But they weren't really too concerned because they had already been there twice that day for identical false alarms.
Okay. Oh, it's the pile that cried wolf.
Yeah. And so there wasn't an obvious fire, but there was steam coming out from one of the buildings. And that building contained the stationary low power reactor number one, also known as SL1.
Huh. SL1.
How'd they come up with that?
Yeah, no, it's tough.
That's another one of those acronyms.
Acronyms. Oh, yeah. I know that word.
SL1. You'll be shocked to hear there was no SL2 for obvious reasons.
There was no SL2.
So as they approached, the radiation detectors read 25 rem per hour, which in civilized units is 250 millisieverts per hour.
If you want to hear Norm rail about radioactive units, I think it's episode 20 and 21 about Chernobyl.
I don't even remember anymore.
Some feelings,
man.
About
you know what? I'm gonna.
It's a measurement for radiation.
I'm gonna stamp it. And if I'm wrong, so be it. Don't edit it out. We're leaving it in.
So they're outside the station, mm-hmm. and this is reading is about 40 times the annual average radiation they're getting.
Oh, that's not good.
So there's radiation.
Uh huh.
Sure.
They enter the building. Mm-hmm. The firefighters enter the building, and then this radiation maxes out on their meters at 200 rem per hour.
So it couldn't be more than 200.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously this maxed out reading is well beyond the lethal dose in minutes,
mm-hmm.
forcing them to call for help and retreat.
And crap their pants.
Good,
yeah, and not on purpose.
And figure like, oh boy. I think something's wrong.
You guys.
Yeah.
So by 10:45, the responders finally reached the reactor room of SL1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They found two men there soaked in radioactive water. One was already dead, and the other one was semi-conscious, moaning on the ground.
Oh, boy.
Grizzly.
It was not known at this time, but this was the deadliest nuclear reactor accident in American history.
What?
Wow. Never heard of it.
Although I have heard of that guy who got
the
hit
the... Blue Man.
It was like a Tragedy Tuesday.
The original Blue Man group.
It was like a flash of radiation
yeah.
that he got when he was looking into some kind of like purifying
chamber. That's actually related to this.
Oh, cool.
There we go.
What was that guy's name?
Kelly something?
Yeah, Cecil Kelly.
Cecil Kelly.
Yep. Hey.
Episode something.
It's episode on this show that we
look up Cecil Kelly and how he ended.
Okay, good. Actually, I'll reference that when we get to that part because I know a lot about that guy.
Oh, nice.
All right.
Awesome.
You come to the right place.
Right place, right time.
Because we don't.
All right, let's get serious. Sidebar.
All right, nice. Sidebar!
I don't know if you've had one yet. You might be the first sidebar.
Yeah.
We're going to add in one of those.
Didn't you guys have sidebars in the previous two episodes we recorded?
I don't think
well,
so.
Well, they were mine, so
sidebars.
No sidebars. Okay,
well. Murderous hippies.
Okay, sidebar. Yeah. On the Cold War. So the Cold War was literally cold around the Arctic Circle, which is the North Pole.
and the
Arctic is tactically valuable as it represents the shortest path between the USSR to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. It's very sparsely populated, so it's actually very easy for either side to attack the other unnoticed because of its sparse population.
I've got a sub sidebar. Mm-hmm. Remember back in like February when shit started to go down in Ukraine?
Yeah.
And everybody was like, oh shit, wait a second. What about Russia coming up over the Arctic and invading us?
Yeah.
Until Russia got onto Ukrainian soil and shit their pants on a world stage. Remember that one?
I do.
And then those words went away.
We'll soon explain why they wouldn't be invading anybody.
Okay.
Via the
North Pole.
Ever.
Via the North Pole.
Cool.
So. But at the time, this was a high priority for the Americans to develop some sort of system to monitor the Arctic for incoming bombers or even land vessels, although I don't know why they'd come on land and then walk across Canada to get to America.
Same reason they'd
portage
get a bunch of
their
tanks stuck in mud.
Yeah. Yeah.
Theoretically.
This is hard.
Purely theoretical.
This is the Cold War. It's the 60s. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
So to address this, the United States and Canada established the Distant Early Warning Line, also known as the Dew Line.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about the Dew Line.
Yeah, the Dew Line.
It was a chain of radar stations across Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Iceland. Mm-hmm. And it would essentially provide several hours of advance notice if a plane were to come over the Arctic Circle and attack the U.S. Because obviously they're not going to bomb Canada. They're going to fly over Canada and go right to the United States.
Forget Canada.
Yeah.
No one ever remembers Canada.
Yeah. So from 1954 to 57, 63 radar stations were built in the North. And it cost $1 billion, which is $10 billion in today's money.
Holy crap. Yeah. So they were real worried.
And so these stations were powered by diesel generators, but obviously due to their mass remoteness, the stations were logistically extremely difficult to resupply.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there was a desire for the Army who ran these stations to upgrade them with small nuclear reactors such that they could run for years.
Nuclear everything.
There you go.
Nuclear everything.
So in the Cold War, though, the United States and the USSR were constantly trying to one-up each other in this race for scientific development. Mm-hmm. And you guys have talked a bunch of things about this.
Chernobyl
mostly.
Space race. Yeah, space race. Yeah. And October 57, the Soviets launched Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite in human history.
Right. Yep.
And then they followed that up in November with Sputnik 2. So they had two satellites out before the Americans did anything.
Mm. Yeah. And every time they would orbit over the White House, they would just hear the president swearing. Fucking Russians!
And they had these two little birds that would shoot out the sides.
Well, the satellites weren't actually the important thing that was demonstrated, though. Mm-hmm. What was actually important was that they had demonstrated space rockets that carried those satellites.
Right.
And that was the intimidating thing.
Yeah.
Because this launch happened 9 weeks after the Dew Line was finished, rendering the Dew Line immediately obsolete because space rockets could drop nukes from space without needing to fly bombers over.
Great. Although, I guess the U.S. could take some solace. I just have another mini. Are we still in a sidebar?
Oh, yeah. This is the Cold War.
Okay, nice. Sidebar. Okay. Nice little sub-sidebar. I'm currently reading a book on Operation Paperclip.
Oh.
So I guess the U.S. could take some solace. The Soviets got the second-tier Nazis that kind of knew what was going on with the rockets. But the U.S. got Von Braun and all the other monsters that used slave labor to build their rockets.
Right.
So at least there's...
Yeah, that. I mean, they got the rocket knowledge. That's true.
I feel like I should just do an episode about Operation Paperclip. It's kind of a disaster.
I thought that's why you were reading the book.
Well, now it is.
Now it is.
You know, we'll talk about it. The short version is Operation Paperclip, U.S., during the end of towards the end of the Second World War, went to Germany, got a bunch of Nazi scientists, brought them back over here. That's why we won the space race.
You work for us now.
Yeah.
And that's why we won the space race.
There you go.
Exactly.
Right. So the Russians had functional space rockets.
Yep.
Yes.
In December 57, the Americans rushed to catch up with their first rocket attempt. Mm-hmm. This was the Vanguard project.
Ooh.
It lifted off a few feet before crashing and exploding.
Shit. Mm. Well, at least it had a cool name.
Name wasn't really equal to its feet.
Damn.
So that embarrassing event obviously amplified public anxiety in the West. And so while USSR was winning the space race, there were actually two areas where the Americans actually were ahead.
Okay.
Nuclear power and submarines.
Hmm.
Okay.
The first nuclear-powered submarine.
Kind of the opposite of space.
Mash them together.
The submarine was called the Nautilus, and it was developed in secret and launched in 1954. So they had this the whole time.
Right.
Sweet.
But they weren't hey, Russia, want to see our secret weapon?
Right. And wasn't the captain Sean Connery?
No.
Yeah.
In, what was that, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Was he the captain of that, or did he just look like Sean Connery?
You're thinking of Hunt for Red October.
That's a different... No, I'm crossing things. Because I'm thinking about the Disney movie.
You're making a joke.
No, I'm just trying to be a joke.
Oh, I get it.
The submarine was called the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues... Nemo.
Captain Nemo.
Is that Sean Connery?
In...
Or just look like Sean Connery?
I never saw that movie.
Kind of looked like
I feel
fish.
Like I'm ruining Norm's episode. I should just shut my mouth. Hey, Norm,
I think you're doing a great job. Really enhancing everyone, ruining it, yeah.
Yeah, so this was the first nuclear-powered submarine.
Awesome.
And the reactor was developed at the National Reactor Testing Center. Station, right? Mm-hmm. National Reactor Testing Station.
In Idaho.
In Idaho.
In Idaho, yeah. So conventional subs run on diesel with battery powers, but they need to resurface every few days to actually intake oxygen because they're burning combustion engines.
Right. And is it typically that the diesel generators charge the batteries and they run off the batteries?
Yeah. So they'll charge with diesel, batteries, but then they'll still need to get oxygen every once in a while.
Makes sense.
So a nuclear sub can stay submerged indefinitely for years if needed, undetected.
So cool. Jeez.
So that's interesting. So to ease the
like
public,
being out of space.
Yeah, to ease the public anxiety from the Vanguard fiasco, the Navy publicly demonstrated this submarine on the 1st of August, 1958.
Okay.
The Nautilus crossed the North Pole from Alaska to Greenland, completely submerged beneath the ice sheet.
Awesome.
And undetected, obviously.
Yeah.
And amazing. So that demonstration presented a threat that they could just move submarines anywhere they wanted and launch nukes much easier than the Russians could.
Right.
So that swung the technological balance back in favor of the United States.
Awesome.
In the Cold War.
Nice.
Hmm.
Yeah, interesting. So submarines beats space rockets.
So I was kind of on point with Sean Connery. I wasn't completely off base.
No, you were, yeah.
On Fred October.
Exactly. Whatever you need, you know.
So the Navy reactors, such as the one used in the Nautilus, these were the darlings of the nuclear industry because they were getting them all the attention. They were super high tech, super cool, and they were winning the war.
Right.
But as we mentioned earlier, though, the Army was also interested in the small reactors for those Arctic stations, even though by the time this got rolling, they didn't need the Arctic stations.
Right.
They, you know, you start a project, it becomes null. Like, I might as well continue the project anyway. It's the government. You never know when you're going to need these.
Sure. Oh, fair enough.
We don't need them now, but
yeah,
maybe.
Can you use them for, like, missile detection? What's NORAD?
I don't know.
Seems like something
and I just
from...
watched NOR games. War games.
I mean, I know they reference it in Independence Day.
Yeah, right. They use NORAD.
That is all I know.
NORAD. Isn't it like a missile detection?
Yeah, it must be.
North.
No way to find out.
Ontario Rocket Alliance Detection. I got nothing.
Yeah, so the idea with the...
That's probably the...
That's right.
Yeah, the Army reactors, the small reactors, is that they're small and super simple and super basic because they have to be easy to maintain. They have to make a bunch of them for all these stations in the dew line, and they would build the components off site, ship them to the bases, and then the people there would assemble them. So they were very utilitarian. There was nothing really new about them, and they didn't really gain much publicity or fanfare as much as the Navy stuff was. So Navy cool, Army drool.
Ah.
You heard it here first.
There you go. Army.
But despite the lack of prestige of these reactors, though, there was always allure of working any nuclear job. Because remember, this is 1950s and 1960s.
Oh, yeah, nuclear everything.
Yeah, nuclear is the future, right? Yeah. Like, and if you were in the Army and you're like, oh, I don't want to go to war, but if I go to this nuclear training, I can run a reactor, serve my time in the Army, then get hired at one of the several nuclear plants that are opening up as the only people in the world with any skills in nuclear and just make it rich because nuclear is everything.
Nuclear is the future. It's never going away. Mm-mm. Nobody's going to poo-poo it and
it'll never get a bad reputation.
Nobody's going to shut down all of their nuclear reactors in the 21st century.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, there were no severe incidents prior to this point.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But even the severe incidents that, you know what, just listen to our episodes about Chernobyl.
Yeah, so
you'll get our thoughts.
Similarly, if you want to know more about nuclear power, because we're going to skip all the discussion about neutrons and stuff.
Yeah.
It's been done.
Episodes 20, 20.5, and 21.
I was right.
You were right.
On Chernobyl and Three Mile Island.
It feels good.
There you go.
Yeah, I had it written down.
Nice. I was right.
Yeah, feels so the stationary low power reactor one was the reactor that was developed for these bases.
Yep.
And as you can tell by the name, it was stationary, so it wasn't meant for a submarine. It was meant to stay in place.
Makes sense.
Okay. Good. And it was low power. Low power.
Yep.
It was developed by Argonne National Labs.
Oh. Named after the element.
No.
Damn it.
Spelled differently, completely differently.
Damn it.
So close.
They contracted out the operation of these reactors to Combustion Engineering Incorporated, who was responsible for training the military personnel on the running the reactor. The reactor was finished in July 1958. And due to the low power output of this reactor, it was deemed that it was not necessary to have a containment building.
Why? Okay. Why is it? It's always necessary. Always necessary.
Well, not necessary, but maybe a good idea.
Right?
So there is logic in this, in that they can't really build 3-foot thick concrete containment buildings for 56 bases every single place they need to use these reactors. So they make it low power enough.
Or don't wanna?
Yeah.
They make it low power enough to not blow up as badly.
Cool. Badly.
What was
Sir,
that?
It's hard.
Also, I seem to remember, I don't know where I heard this, but I heard some story about someone being covered in like radioactive water and dying instantly.
Mm. Was
that
familiar?
Was that a few?
That was actually a flashback.
Was that a few minutes days?
Ago? Or a few minutes.
Oh, okay.
So
let's see how this goes.
Go on.
SL1 was a 3 megawatt thermal boiling water reactor. Mm-hmm. And for reference, that is 1,000 times less than one of the reactors at Chernobyl.
Oh, wow.
Of which there were four. So it's 1,000 times less than one of them.
Low. Okay.
And so a boiling water reactor literally has water directly in the core that boils into steam. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much the simplest possible design, which, again, this is on purpose, right? Because these are meant to be assembled by army men and operated by army men.
Right.
We can't have any fancy things, heavy water or anything weird or pressurized. Can't have that.
It's the IKEA version.
It used highly enriched uranium. In fact, it only used 14 kilograms, 31 pounds of fuel. And it would basically be able to run for 3 years on 14 kilos of uranium.
Sweet.
For reference, Chernobyl reactor has 192 tons of fuel, or 14,000 times more fuel.
Oh, geez.
Sheesh.
Okay.
That's the yardstick.
So 14 kilograms will run it for 3 years, huh?
So they use much higher enriched uranium than a standard nuclear reactor, like way, way, way higher, like beyond reason, because they needed it to be as efficient as possible specifically. So like the fuel could be more expensive to make, but then you would fuel it once and then leave it, right?
Mm-hmm. Set it and forget it.
Yeah.
So once the reactor
George Foreman
was
grill.
Once the reactor is ready, the Army and the Navy sent people to Idaho Falls to get special training on this new reactor. Mm-hmm. Army operators would spend 4 months in classes doing basic nuclear theory. And just for reference, I have more nuclear background than that.
Oh boy.
Interesting. Good setup.
And I've never run a nuclear reactor before.
Haven't you?
Okay.
No. After that, they would get 4 months of actual operator training on simulators and conventional reactors, highly supervised by people.
Right.
All right. They're doing their
So that's better than me.
They're trying.
Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah.
And this also included psychological evaluations.
That's important. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But maybe you'll know how good social psychology was in the 50s.
Super accurate. I'll tell you that much.
Crazy or you're not.
You're basically.
Yeah. Okay.
This story will.
And if you are, go away.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
The story will. It'll suggest how good their evaluation.
Stuff it down with some brown.
Yeah. Exactly.
Whiskey.
Exactly.
So they didn't have advanced nuclear knowledge, but they were essentially trained on a need to know basis as to how to use and maintain these reactors.
Yeah. See, I'm gonna posit that when you're running a nuclear reactor, you kind of need to know everything. What does this knob do? You don't need to know.
Soldier, you're on a need to know basis.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you when to push it.
It's easier for us, like,
I talk. But what if you're not around?
Like 60 years in the future to go back and laugh at these people.
Yeah, well, of course.
But remember, in the 60s. We're
so smug.
Have you heard this podcast?
To unravel the very premise of what we're doing.
But like in the 60s, right? Like you have to remember, America was the nuclear power.
Yep.
They were the masters of the atom.
Oh, yeah.
There had never been an accident before. Mm-hmm. Reactors were like, they were just machines.
Mm-hmm.
They were understood, right?
What could go wrong?
Like, operation was routine.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Road to the Jetsons right here.
Yep.
It's where things were headed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Continue.
So.
What could go wrong?
So the reactor itself, the core, is about 14 feet long and 5 feet in diameter, and was oriented vertically and then welded into the ground.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty small for a reactor. Like, that's obviously the size of a room.
Yeah, you could build that here.
Yeah.
So it's welded into the ground. The fuel is bundled into things called fuel assemblies, and these assemblies are long rectangular boxes that are slid into the reactor in a grid. So it kind of looks like a bunch of skyscrapers next to each other.
Cool.
Right. And then the reactor output power is controlled by control rods, which we've talked about before.
Oh, we know about control rods.
We know those rods.
So the control rods, as they're inserted into the core, they will slow the reactor down, slow the reaction rate down.
Right.
Reducing the power. As you pull the control rods out, the reaction rate increases, the reactor generates more power.
Mm-hmm.
So you control how much power you want with the position of the control rods within that core.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Is there a scram?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Nice.
That's something they learned right from the beginning with the Axeman, if you recall.
Oh, yeah, the Axeman.
Yeah. Is in this situation, is there a soldier with like a fire axe, or is it like
there's a sniper aiming at a rope? So the control rods aren't actually rods in the case. In this case, they're actually sheets or blades that basically slide in between the pillars of these boxes.
Sounds like a magic guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they would.
Illusion.
Yes.
There it is.
Nice. And yeah.
One an episode.
One per app.
Classic rods. So in this particular reactor, for the case of January 3rd, 1961, it was configured to use only 5 control rods.
Okay.
Each control rod was 81 centimeters long, so about 2.5 feet, and weighed about 22 kilograms, about 48 pounds.
It's a pretty small reactor.
Yep.
Yeah.
For reference, so there were 5 control rods. For reference, Chernobyl had 211 control rods.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Chernobyl's like the Beatles of the nuclear reactors, eh?
Yeah.
Speaking of Beatles, I'm going to derail us for a second.
Okay.
I had my mind blown recently.
Uh-huh.
The band named The Beatles.
Yes.
Is a pun on the word beat.
That's right.
Beatles.
Like the beat of the music.
Not the animal.
Yeah.
No, it's spelled differently.
Sure is. Carry on.
There's things in life you just take for granted, aren't there? 30
years.
Yeah, sure.
30 years I hadn't thought about it until someone pointed it out, and I was like, what the f-?
I had something like that yesterday. Recently, I can't remember what it was. Yeah. But I was like, oh, it's because of that.
Yeah.
I'm the literally last person in the world to figure that out.
That seemed to be, that's me and the Beatles.
They're a good band.
How are we talking about the Beatles?
Chernobyl's the Beatles of nuclear reactors. It's always like the reference.
Yep. Looping it around.
Yeah, you know, the Beatles had 211 guitar players compared to the standard Slipknot with 5.
Right. That's too much.
What are we talking about? Control rods. Control rods had one primary control rod right down the middle of the reactor, and then 4 other ones slotted sort of equidistant around that.
Okay, I think.
But because of this particular funky orientation, the central control rod had disproportionate control over the reaction rate.
Mm-hmm.
And if that control rod was inserted fully, it would stop the reaction entirely, regardless of the position of the other rods.
Uh-oh.
Conversely, if that one rod was pulled out, it would start the reactor regardless of the position of the other rods.
Design
counterintuitive,
flaw, I guess.
The reactor itself actually had the capability of using, I think it was 9 control rods, but it was in an even lower fuel state with fewer control rods. So you think less fuel, less control rods is better, but fewer control rods means you have less fine control over your reaction.
Right.
Usually when you insert something fully, it causes a reaction.
It sure
That's
does.
That's where my brain goes.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Like thinking about like barbecue starters.
Yeah, that's what I had in mind. Barbecue starters.
Keys into ignition. That
yeah,
kind of
or a lock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Anything else come to mind? Like a
enough innuendos though. These control rods are normally connected to long shafts.
Long shafts, you say?
Yes. So the control rods are connected to these long shafts, which are then connected to motors, which drive the rods and control their position inside the core. So it's not somebody pushing it in with a broomstick. There's an electronic motor that moves
a little more of a deft hand.
The control rods in and out.
Yeah. Okay.
Not an act. Okay. Yes.
That's normal operation.
Yep.
So let's get back to time here. Christmas 1960, right before the date that we're talking about.
What's on the radio, Lee?
Christmas 1960.
1960. I don't know.
Jingle Balls.
Is that a Marvin Gaye time or is that later?
That's later, I think.
Okay.
60? I don't know. I'm sorry.
Probably some Sinatra.
Yeah, why don't...
Probably some Elvis Christmas songs.
You, oh, yeah. Why don't Sinatra, you guys, every time you sure. do like a thing in the past, figure yeah. out what music was around then?
Should.
Yeah, we should, instead of just being like, all right, like, here's the techno song that I'm using yeah. for this old...
sometimes I try, and yeah. then sometimes I really don't try.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, when we're playing a hurdle, which is that music guessing yep, game...
Which we love.
So good.
I can never guess the songs unless it's like... 2000s dance.
Yeah, the only time I ever, only time I ever post my results is when I get it in like the first second. Other than that, like if I'm getting to like three, I'm like, ah, fuck this.
Oh. Even three and you get yeah. it?
Yeah. I mean, like if it's NSYNC or Destiny's Child, I'll get it on the first beat.
Yeah.
If it's literally yeah. anything yeah. else, yeah. it's a miss.
But everyone got You Can Call Me Out.
Yeah, oh yeah, instantly.
Yeah, like, oh, come on.
All right, Christmas 1960.
Oh, my God.
So SL1 was yep. intentionally shut down for the holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to do this, they disconnect that central control rod manually from its drive system so that you couldn't accidentally hit a switch and turn it on. It's permanently shut down for this break.
So fair enough.
Completely disconnected.
Good plan.
I mean, this kind of glossing over shutting down a reactor for Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, no one's gonna be there.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's nuclear like takes a holiday yeah. too.
I mean, it's not like powering anything
well, okay,
useful.
Sure, it's still a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
I feel like once you got it going, you don't want to fuck with it too much.
Well, this is an experiment. This is a test reactor, so they're switch. Like they're fiddling around learning
gotcha,
how to do
gotcha,
things.
Gotcha,
yeah. On off.
Okay.
Yeah, and when work resumed on January 3rd, 1961,
mm-hmm.
The day shift, they fell behind on getting the reactor started. So they left a huge list of various maintenance tasks for the night shift crew.
This sounds really familiar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, nothing ever happened poorly on the night shift in Chernobyl or Three Mile Island certainly or literally not. Everything else.
Certainly not when they're behind schedule.
No.
Certainly not when they're cutting corners.
Yeah. Ship shape.
Mm-hmm.
The night shift consisted of three men with a combined 3 years of experience on the reactor.
Combined.
One of combined IQ of...
combined IQ of something
but combined
small.
Experience of 3 years. Yeah. So one of them had, like, 2 years... And
yeah, the other was
11 months.
That's actually kind of what it was.
Oh, God.
So the three men were names Army Specialist John Burns, Army Specialist Richard McKinley, and Navy Electrician Richard C. Legg.
Oh, sorry, some conflict there. It's Army and Navy.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Also, note there were no officers or combustion engineering supervisors available.
Hmm.
It was just those three men.
I feel like you want somebody to supervise the combustion.
Yeah. I'm sure they were still the best.
So, right. some background on these gentlemen.
Yes, please. Oh,
sure.
Richard C. Legg, age 26. Yes, he did go by Dick.
You're darn right.
Yeah. So the Navy guy, the Navy electrician, yes, was Dick C. Legg.
Come on.
It's kind of like, maybe it's more like a Dixie Legg. Like maybe he
like
likes
a Dixie
dancing.
Leg. Yeah. He's
so Dixie Legg.
He's a dancer.
Legg climbed the ladder to the rank of shift supervisor for the reactor,
right. Okay.
Which is somewhat surprising because he was described as belligerent.
Sometimes that's what it takes.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Soon after he was promoted to shift supervisor, he was caught by the plant superintendent.
Super Nintendo.
Kicking back with his feet on the reactor control panel.
Amazing.
Like Homer Simpson.
Literally Homer Simpson.
Anywhere else. Just put them anywhere else.
And this is where the belligerent comes in. He was confronted, and then he got an argument with the superintendent, and he refused to put his feet down.
Just.
Cool.
Don't.
This is where I die.
Just don't.
This guy was in charge.
All I can think of is John Travolta and Broken Arrow telling that other dude not to shoot at the nuclear weapons. Like, don't put your feet on the nuclear control panel.
Well, it wasn't that important to me until you told me not to.
Yeah.
Now I won't move them ever.
This is the hill I die on. Poor choice of words.
He was a very indignant fella. So he was also found sleeping in his car while on duty, showing up to work drunk.
Okay.
Wow.
He's only supervising a nuclear reactor. So
this is the inspiration for Homer Simpson.
He also intentionally set off alarms to prank the other people.
Jesus.
Good one.
Fucking.
This guy's the Joker.
Yeah. Nuclear, you're the power of a sun is what you're in charge of. So pretend that it's important.
Try and take this seriously, please, Mr. Legg.
So see, he also falsified an attendance record for a friend. Okay. When he was confronted by his sergeant about this at the recent Christmas party, he challenged the sergeant to a fist fight.
I mean, that doesn't answer my question.
This guy have a metal plate in his
head? I mean, everything I said is like...
No, I just want an answer about the sheets.
This is the definition of belligerent. Like, yeah, it's like, that's a perfect word for this.
Nothing like a good old-fashioned punching can't fix.
Did you sign Johnson in on his shift? How about this? How about we go outside?
You want a piece of me?
No.
Knuckle sandwich. Sign your face with my fist.
Yeah. Okay. So SL-1 was an army reactor, but Legg was a Navy guy. So that's weird that he became supervisor.
Drama. Yeah.
So you can kind of see though that he was dumped on this project as the problem child from the Navy, because this is an unglamorous project the Navy didn't care about.
Right.
They wanted someone on it. So they kind of get the idea that was a dance of the lemon Tim onto this project.
What?
So that was a Richard Legg.
Dance of the Lemon.
It's a reference I don't get. Oh. I'm sure it's a good one.
It's a government phrase where every team has like one
problem
lemon,
child.
Turd.
Sure. Right.
And you like promote or move them to a parallel department.
Yeah.
So you have the people rotating around these crappy positions.
Yeah, yeah.
And the people that come in are probably some other department's lemon. So it's the dance of lemons, and you're just hoping your lemon's better than the one you ditched.
Like, oh, you're that guy. Great. Let's get you out of here.
Also, another quick tip. If you look around the room and you can't find the lemon, it's probably you.
I don't know who the fucking lemon is. It's pricks.
So that's Dixie Legg.
Dixie Legg.
Dick is right.
Dick C. Legg.
Yeah.
So John Burns, age 22, was the other, was one of the army specialists.
Yeah. Really hope that name doesn't come back to bite him in the ass.
John
Burns.
Burns. Mm. Does he? We'll see.
Well, he sounds pretty good. Okay, what's the next line here? Oh, he was a notorious loose cannon.
Oh, boy.
Great.
This is who you want in charge. This is
belligerent and loose cannon.
Good. So, 0-2.
Okay.
He was described as someone who complained excessively, couldn't control his temper, and would throw tools in frustration.
Oh, he's my son.
I mean, is your son 22?
Not yet.
No.
Also, I'm exaggerating. My son's fine. You guys know my son. He's fine.
He's a good guy.
So John Burns was married, though.
Lucky lady.
Yeah. He had weekly public fights with his wife, with screaming and throwing clothes on the lawn.
Okay. Is he throwing the clothes or is she?
Both. Okay. I don't know how many clothes were permanently on the lawn.
I want a word picture.
And shockingly, Burns and Legg had a history together. They got into a drunken brawl at a prostitute's house after a bachelor party.
Wow.
Did Burns ask Legg what time it was?
Obviously it's like awkward because Legg is his boss now at this place.
Yeah, that'll do it.
The third guy was an army guy, Richard McKinley. He was the oldest, age 27. He was a Korean War veteran, serving 4 years in the Air Force, 4 years in the Army. And by all accounts, he was level-headed and a responsible family man.
Okay.
But he had just arrived there 3 weeks ago and was training, so he was the trainee.
Oh,
okay.
So he had the most responsible, oldest, most experienced guy as the trainee, and a loose cannon and a short fuse.
That's always an awkward position to be in.
Yeah.
And I know you guys have the seniority, but can I offer some thoughts?
Like maybe feet off.
The console. Oh, but I'm a respectful person and I really I understand the pecking order here. But so I'm just gonna keep my mouth shut.
But that, like,
these guys are gonna kill us.
He's got his feet next to that big red button.
And it seems looks important. Like he's he is sleeping. Oh jeez.
So one of the critical maintenance tasks for this three-man night shift crew on January 3rd was to reconnect that main control rod to the drive because it was disconnected for that Christmas break.
Yeah, it's important.
Yep.
This has to be done manually by pulling the rod up about 4 inches and then reconnecting it to the control mechanism.
Okay.
And so moving the rods up about 4 inches is actually safe enough to not actually start the reactor.
Fair enough.
So well done.
Still stressful that this is a situation where you could theoretically manually start a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
don't pull it out too much.
Well, the instructions say only pull it out 4 inches.
Okay, well, I'm sure they'll give or take. I'm sure they'll listen to
only withdraw 4 inches, and then it's all good.
Put a loose cannon in charge of that.
Oh God!
So the control rods would occasionally get stuck, often making their movements unpredictable.
Oh no!
From February 59 to November 1960. There were 40 recorded cases of stuck rods.
Oh, God. I know how this is going to
go. It only got more frequent from November to December. So that's 2 months. It got even more frequent than that, leading to January 3rd.
Oh, boy.
The stuck rods.
That'll get you.
My favorite punk band.
Stuck rods. Well, it is now.
Yeah, it is now.
We're starting a new band.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, they're likely stuck due to boron flaking off the rod. So boron flake is your first single.
Nice.
Boron flake by the stuck rods.
I like it.
I like it.
So the maximum withdrawal distance, though, of these rods to produce power in the reactor. So this, like, when the reactor's running, it would pull the rods out about 16 inches.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So 4 inches, good. Nothing happens. Okay. 16 inches, the reactor's going full blast.
Okay. Full blast. Okay. Yeah.
That's quite the difference.
Yeah. I mean, but so you're manually pulling out this rod, four inches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is however long I said it was before.
So 4 inches is how far you want to pull it out.
Yeah, yeah. The rod itself is 2.5 feet long.
Right, okay.
Right.
So you're not pulling it much its own length. Yeah. Just a little bit. But like you're literally just pulling it up to hook it onto a thing.
Yeah,
like,
gotcha. Gotcha.
But this is obviously a dangerous task. Yeah. Everybody knows this. But so this is exactly the type of thing Army specialists are trained for. Mm-hmm. Right? They're trained to like load explosives.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So when they say this is how you load this reactor, they should know exactly how to do this.
Sir, yes, right.
Sir.
Yeah.
So yeah. No risk if everyone knows everything.
Sure.
Yep.
And how much 4 inches is. Yeah.
Because it was actually commonly stated that if these reactors were in the field and the Soviets were to invade, they would yank that control rod out and it would blow up the base.
Oh, okay.
So like this was kind of like a safe. You know, a story people would tell. So everyone knew. Yeah. They wouldn't like, I didn't know that. This is a control rod. What's that?
Well known. That,
yeah.
Well known. Oh, on the night of January 3rd, our friend Burns had previously spent the 2 nights sleeping on his friend's couch after another fight with his wife.
Good. Good start.
At 7 p.m. into his shift, he received a phone call from her demanding a divorce. What took her so long?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
2 hours and 1 minute later, the reactor SL1 exploded.
Oh, boy.
Let's connect those dots.
So we're not saying it was... Okay.
It's believed that the team was performing the central rod reconnection procedure at the time, with Burns lifting the rod and leg assisting him, and McKinley was observing/helping them. In 4 milliseconds, the reactor surged to about 100,000 times its normal operating power.
Not good.
Mm.
It flash boiled all the water in the core, causing a steam explosion the equivalent of 32 kilograms of TNT.
Holy crap.
The explosion blew this 12,000 kilogram reactor vessel that was welded to the ground up and out 9 feet.
Holy crap. Wow.
The control rods and the lid plugs were shot out of the reactor like missiles.
Shit.
This entire event from when presumably the central rod was pulled until explosion took 4 seconds.
Seconds. Can't even process what's happening.
That is... Yeah. A very quick and violent reaction.
That's ridiculous.
So back to the first responders.
Uh-huh.
This is where we circle back to the beginning here.
Yeah.
The rescue team found Burns. He was dead on the floor.
Okay.
Covered in soaking water.
Okay.
McKinley was alive, but barely conscious. They managed to stretcher both them out, but McKinley died very soon after.
Right, boy. Right.
For safety, their corpses were actually stored at a chemical plant nearby in stainless steel lined room. What was thought to be a pile of rags pinned to the ceiling was Richard C. Legg.
Oh, boy.
With that pile of rags pinned to the ceiling.
Oh, no.
The reactor
weird,
plug.
Don't worry about it.
The reactor plug had shot out like a railgun, impaling him directly through his groin and pinning him.
Oh, yeah! Oh my God.
What a way to go.
No.
There was actually fear that attempting to remove Leg from the ceiling would actually result in his corpse falling into the reactor core again.
Uh-huh.
And if he had enough radioactive material on him, that could trigger another explosion.
Oh,
so they couldn't just like yank him down.
Scrape him off.
It took 6 days to come up with a plan to rescue. Well, retrieve him. And they created a slide-like stretcher on a crane to catch his body.
That's a problem-solving team you don't want to be on.
It took four teams of 10 men working in 65-second intervals to retrieve that body.
God.
So how do we retrieve this? Disincorporate him.
All right, 64, 65, you're up.
Oh, Jesus.
So Leg, this is the interesting part. He was completely preserved by the radiation.
Okay.
And that his body wasn't decaying, because like obviously he has no like bacteria or anything in him left to decay the body. So it didn't decay like a typical corpse would after 6 days.
Right.
He was weirdly preserved.
Well, most of him was.
The bodies were so mutilated that Leg and McKinley were actually misidentified as each other. They had to use their, one of them had a tattoo, which was how they were able to ultimately figure out who was who.
Right.
So the autopsy. There had never been a nuclear disaster on this level in America, so not many people knew even what to do with radioactive corpses.
Right. Uh-huh. Where to start? Yeah.
This is where Dr. Clarence Lushbaugh comes in.
Okay.
He was the guy that did the autopsy on the Cecil Kelly incident.
Hey,
there we go.
Tragedy Tuesday.
And he was the only one that had any experience with radioactive corpses in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So Lushbaugh was rushed there by plane. Burns and McKinley were stored in steel tanks filled with ice and alcohol, while Leg, who was the most radioactive, he was about 1,000 times more radioactive than the other two, was stored in a lead cask.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they just have a lead cask. Well, I guess it's for storing radioactive.
You need a lead cask?
Yeah.
Material. So they just stuffed them into a barrel, basically.
I folded them a few times.
So, like, you couldn't get near these corpses, though. So the autopsy team had to weld hacksaws onto 10-foot-long steel pipes, and they had to wear lead aprons and lead shields to autopsy the body from 10 feet away.
Oh, my God.
Wow. That's just the weirdest puppet show.
That's so ridiculous. Yeah.
The autopsies were thorough. They were thorough. Dr. Lushbaugh's a professional, even though in the story of the Cecil Kelly, there's a lot of stuff about shipping brains in mayonnaise jars.
Yeah, I think I remember
that's
some
right.
of that. Yep.
So, it was determined that McKinley had died from bleeding due to the explosion. Burns had died from being thrown, hitting a wall, and then his rib broke and punctured his heart. Leg, who was pinned to the ceiling, died from, quote,
no.
destruction of his viscera by rapidly expanding gases that penetrated his abdominal cavity along with a heavy missile, end quote. So he was inflated and then popped like a balloon.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
In layman's terms.
Oh, my God.
That shouldn't happen to a human.
No, it should not.
That's what happens to a balloon.
That is what happens to a balloon. Yeah.
The viscera, you know what, that needs to be deflated.
No, you don't want your viscera inflated. I'll tell you that much. I'm not a doctor. But of all the things you want inflated, your viscera is bottom of the list.
Is your viscera
your guts.
Your guts.
Yeah, it's your guts.
Right.
It's just a giblets.
You're basically,
your gutty works.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
The bodies could not be decontaminated in any way for a conventional burial, even in lead caskets. The army actually wanted to just stuff them in barrels and store them bury them as nuclear waste. The families of the three men disagreed with that.
Okay. Different ideas.
Yeah. They were not like, don't just chuck them in the desert.
Well, that guy's ex-wife was. Yes, please.
they weren't divorced yet. So Dr. Lushbaugh decided to remove the most radioactive parts of the three men and burying those along with their waste.
All of them?
Well, it actually was McKinley's left hand and Leg's entire head were removed.
Okay.
The remainder of the bodies could be buried in lead-lined caskets covered in concrete with very short funerals.
Very short.
I guess I didn't think about
he
that.
He lived, he died at the end. Get out!
Yeah, I believe the Atomic Energy Commission had, like, Geiger counters, like, literally at the funerals.
Right.
And, like, they would not allow the families any closer than a certain distance for a certain amount of time.
Wow.
And then it was just filled with concrete after.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
And you thought COVID was bad.
Wow.
Wow.
Hard hitting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So let's examine what happened. So it was actually initially believed that this was a chemical explosion because no one thought the core could explode.
Right.
They're like, this is impossible.
Right.
And it wasn't that. So just strike that right off.
Can't be that. Not a chance. Where's the propane that someone left running?
Yeah. Right.
Where are the matches?
But the metal in the men's wristwatches and their wedding rings had become radioactive through neutron exposure.
Huh,
so
that's
how they indeed confirmed that the core was active and critical because it was off. Like they knew it was off,
right?
So it wouldn't have radiated them.
Sure, but maybe they knew what they were doing.
So yeah. The cause was likely due to the rapid removal of that central control rod, mm-hmm. which they were obviously working on.
Right.
They needed it to pull it out 4 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But the investigation actually showed, based off of modeling on how much power mm-hmm. was generated and scratches on the mm-hmm. on the side of the tank. That it was actually pulled out 20 inches. Mm. So way beyond the safe operating limit.
More than the, yeah.
Yeah. And 16 and then 16, 20. Yeah,
you get a little more. You,
20 minus X equals 16.
They've over pulled it by more than a foot.
4 inches.
Yep. So the reactor was water moderated, meaning that if the reaction rate gets too high, the water boils away into steam and mm-hmm. then the reactor slows down. Mm-hmm. This is a safety feature
mm-hmm.
that wasn't in Chernobyl.
Right.
Because basically if you increase the rate too much and it boils away the water, it'll cool itself down.
Right. Yes. Right.
But that only happens if the reaction rate is sort of increased at a normal rate.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
If you were to, say, pull out that central control rod extremely rapidly, the reactor would actually ramp up so fast that it would essentially blow up before it could cool itself down.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So the rod was pulled out extremely quickly.
Mm. Why?
The human factor.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yes. The rod was pulled out 20 inches mm-hmm. and extremely rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
These are 22 kilogram rods, about 48 pounds.
Yeah.
And although it's physically possible, so like you're pulling them from underneath you on a pole.
Yeah.
Although it's physically possible to pull a rod out that fast, it was actually deemed that it's something that was sort of unlikely to occur by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Especially by trained individuals who knew what they were doing. It's possible that the rod was stuck when they're trying to pull it out, and then Burns was like yanking it, right? Then it came loose and he overpulled it.
Right.
That's possible theory.
One explanation, sure.
The official investigation showed that even a stuck rod mm-hmm. that was suddenly unstuck
mm-hmm.
would be unlikely to overpull by that amount.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so they basically did this by recreating the situation, and they showed that on average, they would overpull the rod by about 10 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Or so either, over to pull it to 10 inches, but the 20 inches was extreme.
Right.
And they were really giving her.
And not likely, but not physically impossible.
Okay.
Okay. Interesting.
Guy was just getting a divorce, huh?
Guy's getting a divorce. He had been in a physical altercation with another one of the guys.
You know Leg is taunting him this whole time. Just pull it out, you pussy.
Yeah, just pull
it already.
Don't fuck it up like you fucked up your marriage.
He's sitting with his legs up on that console again, too. Yeah.
Get an interesting phone call.
Yeah. What'd the old lady say?
So the logbook for the reactor showed that other operators had performed this particular task over 500 times and never reported a stuck rod.
Hmm.
In fact, the rods would more commonly get stuck while being inserted rather than removed.
Mm-hmm.
And the sticking was also something that would happen typically when the reactor was on and hot,
right?
And not when it was cold.
There's too many.
I can't even.
There's too many
innuendos
here.
Fill it in yourself.
What you said before. Yeah, just do the jokes yourself.
too many.
We'll be here all night.
So although it was deemed somewhat unlikely that this was an accidental removal. Because it was deemed somewhat unlikely that this was an accidental removal.
Mm-hmm.
the investigation into the personal lives of the three men was performed to see if there was a malicious intent.
They might have started with that.
Yeah.
Before any hiring them.
To find if there's any cause for intentional withdrawal by Burns.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so this is where all, like, obviously we have all this personal information about them. This comes from this,
after
this research. Like, that it wasn't just sense. Like, oh, yeah, everybody knew he did this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It came from a lot of the...
Probably wouldn't have gotten hired.
Yeah.
A lot of this is in the book called... it's a really good book. It's called Atomic America by Todd Tucker. Yeah, so we knew Burns and Legg as part of the investigation from their backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Yep. They were volatile and had a history of getting into fights and fights with each other.
Good.
All good stuff.
It was actually came out that Legg had accused Burns of cheating on his wife with a stripper. There was other speculation that Legg was actually having an affair with Burns' wife.
Oh my God.
Nice.
Reports from the locals said that they would not be surprised if this story, the intentional withdrawal was true.
Uh-huh.
But there was no evidence to actually suggest, there were obviously no paper trail. I'm going to pull out the rod tonight.
Okay.
Dear diary. Tonight's the night.
But obviously, these anecdotes lead to the urban legend that Burns sabotaged the reactor.
Sure.
To
maybe
kill.
Maybe there's no like suicide note, but it sounds like there's overwhelming circumstantial evidence.
It's a little more
evidence.
Believable than, say, Sasquatch or...
I can just—I don't even know these guys, but I can hear Legg taunting him. Like they're like walking into work, just like Legg is chirping him the whole time.
Yeah.
Just like clocking in, walking to the reactor. Legg just does not shut his mouth.
Exactly.
So a few more layers to this investigation. Mm-hmm. The autopsy showed that Burns, who was believed to be the one pulling the rod, had very little burning on his hands or irradiation on his hands, which you would expect from someone who had her hands on the control rod.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was much more likely that Legg was the one handling the rod.
Because he got impaled with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Hmm.
However, with him being the shift supervisor, the most experienced, he would have been the most aware and the least likely to overpull a rod by accident.
Huh.
Right.
Wait a second.
He'd be the least likely to make an error. So this is why it was actually always assumed that Burns was the one pulling the rod, because he was the less experienced one. Yeah. His story lines up with a convenient narrative that... Yeah. absolves the Atomic Energy Commission of negligence.
Right. Plus all that series of jokes I just made about Legg chirping.
Want to keep that true.
Yeah. I want to.
So the Atomic Energy Commission, like, they downplayed that stuck rod theory because, but they never refuted the Burns murder-suicide story, even though the autopsy suggested that he wasn't the one pulling the rod.
Right.
Because it's ultimately easy to blame operator error in this case because they're all dead. They can't defend themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, from the administration's position, it's easy to scapegoat someone. You love scapegoats. Remember Chernobyl and Dyatlov?
Everybody remembers that.
So there's ultimately some insufficient evidence to conclusively explain why it happened, other than that it definitely happened.
Well, yeah.
That much we know. And based on what you've said, I think we're beyond thinking it was a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's put by Legg.
They're playing Dare You? I'll pull it.
They're playing chicken.
15 inches.
God.
So Argonne, which was the reactor designer, they blamed the Army.
Sure.
They were saying it was used improperly. The Army was blaming Combustion Engineering, the contractor, as well as Argonne, saying it was a poor design. Combustion Engineering, they blamed the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reactor was basically being run 24/7 in 3 8-hour shifts.
Mm-hmm.
But they only had supervisors on site for the day shift. So one of the three shifts, the trainers were there.
Yeah.
I think they might have a point.
They requested additional budget to staff all the other shifts, but the Atomic Energy Commission denied that budget. Because they said, well, any advanced procedures are always going to be done in the day shift. Unless the day shift runs behind and they push it onto night shift.
Huh.
Big.
So everyone blamed.
Flash forward to 30 years.
Everyone else. the Cold War ultimately created this underlying urgency for all these military projects. Mm-hmm. So they had been successful rushing projects out the door. And other nuclear reactors never had any incidents. There was an overly false sense of security.
Right.
But in retrospect, obviously the poor engineering and a very low margin of error,
right,
along with lax protocols. Like, they continued operating the reactor despite the fact that it was rods were sticking
right
every day and just got massively stuck.
And your margin of error is literally 12 inches.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was no, like, clutch or, I don't know, like, safety bracket to prevent you from pulling it out in 20 inches.
Yeah. That, and also beyond even that, like, this is a nuclear reactor, and you're relying on a human being pulling something out of it to start.
It's roughly, I know what 4 inches feels like.
I got my safety right here.
Yeah.
Tapping his brain.
All up here.
So the Navy, it's important to point out, this isn't just gross incompetence across the board. The Navy, who is, they've made all the fancy high-tech reactors, they were extremely critical of the Army's handling of the situation. They never mentioned that their guy was in charge. Their lemon was in charge.
Details.
Because the Navy, they responsibly ran their reactors.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
So.
Uh-huh.
as part of the aftermath, a moderate amount of fission products was released into the environment. It was deemed not significant due to the remoteness, because this was kind of in the desert, away from anyone. They're like, we guess it's a little amount. We can't know. And no one's around.
Yeah. See a two-headed walrus, you know.
It took a year and a half to clean up. The waste ended up being buried about 500 meters away from the site, because it was actually too dangerous to transport. Like, this nuclear waste, you can't just put it on a train and take it somewhere else. So the safest place to put it is you bury it in your backyard.
Yeah, right. That's like a situation where you're like, you do something bad, you like screw up, but then you look around, like nobody saw you do it
first,
and then you just kind of like put a bunch of dirt on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They still monitor the radiation in the like the buried radiation. I think something like 10 or 15 years later, it was maybe double background levels at that point. So it's kind of died down.
Smoldering.
Yeah, I mean, so it's all the stuff they cleaned up from this exploded junk, plus the head and hand of those fellas.
That's still there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yes, yeah. So by 94 is when they measured the radiation above ground as about twice background.
Oh, okay.
No, so they were, those were the direct casualties. There were two rescuers, as well as the nurse that was treating McKinley on the way before he died. These three people all eventually died of cancer early, likely due to exposure to these radioactive corpses.
Fair enough.
And ultimately, the Vietnam War started, and it pulled so many resources away from all these sort of random projects. You know, it's like, well, the Viet Cong aren't going to be coming over the Arctic Circle.
No, they're not.
So the Army reactor program slowly wound down, and that's it. SL-1 remains the only fatal reactor incident in United States history, and it was the last of its type.
Oh, boy. Wow. I didn't even know about that.
No.
Yeah, actually, although its design was obviously very flawed, it has led to the modern concept of small modular reactors. So, like, right now, there's, like, a big movement to try to get a very similar concept where you build a bunch of parts, ship them to, like, remote locations or small towns with small
payloads,
amounts of fuel to generate power. And there's actually two of them operating right now.
Right. Didn't I hear about that recently?
Yeah, there's one in China and there's one in Russia, like, on a boat.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
That's awesome.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's
good for them. I'm sure the Russia one will go just fine.
Oh, yeah.
Without any kind of exterior support.
Yeah, so I'll let you connect the dots if you think Leg or Burns was doing something slippery or was just a straight up accident.
I mean, again, for all those jokes I made to hold up, it's got to be Burns pulling the rod.
Yeah, I mean.
So that's my position. Even though I think in my mind, overwhelmed, like you said, you said the rod basically railgunned him to the ceiling. So it's
like,
it's gotta be Leg.
Yeah. Maybe it was a matter of like, I'll get at it. I'll show you how it's done kind of thing.
And, yeah.
I think the less sexy answer is it was just pulled up by accident and everyone's overconfident. They weren't trained properly. There wasn't enough safety and they just yanked it. Doesn't matter who, they yanked it and died.
Like 20 inches. They know what 4 inches is. And they know that it's all like a lot less than 20.
Yeah.
Well, let's interview them and ask.
Have a seance and
like, so we'll dig up the head and ask them what's up.
Yeah. Wow. Mm. That is a disaster. Holy crap.
Indeed.
Yeah. And then just short 30 years later, all over again in Chernobyl.
Exactly. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that was an awesome story. Yeah. I'm so glad that we're doing this again. Can't wait to not sleep after that one.
Yeah.
Did you have any music to go with that?
I do.
Okay.
Yes. My band is Adventures. They are an American sort of emo/indie rock band from Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
They're fun fact, sidebar on Adventures.
Yes.
They're actually a side project of the metalcore band Code Orange.
I know Code Orange.
But they actually disband, like, it consists of all the members of Code Orange except for the main singer, screamer of Code Orange.
Yeah.
Right? But they sort of disbanded when Code Orange got popular, unfortunately.
Mm. Oh.
I actually like Adventures more, but so yeah, the song is Heavenly by Adventures from their 2015 album Supersonic Home. And I like to imagine how stressful the life was back in like the 60s, and like these guys, like these guys are like 22 to 27 years old.
Yeah.
Like, you know, dealing with the Cold War fights with your 22-year-old wife every night.
Right.
And like how now, like, we can just flip on any song we want.
Yeah.
Like the song I'm referencing, and just like sit back and chill or vent or like play a video game, or like you have 1,000 songs on your phone at any moment.
That is very true.
And
we're quite spoiled.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, if they had emo music, it would have prevented it from being disbanded.
Of course. That sounds like a reasonable war.
Yeah.
Although I think about that, I thought about that a lot, especially when this whole conflict happened in Ukraine. Like back during the Cold War was like when Russia first at least revealed that they had nuclear weapons capable of attacking us. It was a new thing. Like the realization that you have a gun pointed at your head at all times was like a new thing.
Yeah.
And that gun didn't go away, but we just lived with it for like 50, 60 more years. But then like when Russia started stirring shit in Ukraine, it's like, oh yeah, we live in a capital city. So still there. It didn't go away.
No, it's just, are you insane enough to pull the trigger?
Well, here we go.
That's the question. Okay. So my song I picked when you had instructed us, what did you say? It's the 60s. It's the height of the Cold War, and it's a nuclear disaster. So I thought of, a band not of the era at all. It's a band called Isotope 217.
Nice.
So we're already on,
check
on
out
brand there.
Science.
Check out science. This band is adjacent to a better known post-rock band called Tortoise.
Yeah, Tortoise.
From Chicago, who I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
Their first album came out in 1997. It's called The Unstable Molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And the first song is the song I picked. It's called Kryptonite Smokes the Red Line. It's kind of like jazzy, and it sounds almost like a movie soundtrack or maybe a spy thriller. It's like there's intrigue and, you know, espionage and stuff. Yep. And it just seemed like a good soundtrack. I didn't know what we were talking about. I know we were just talking about two jerks in a fucking fighting over rods. But still, it would be a good, you know, background.
Yeah.
Soundtrack. This era.
Mm.
Of the nuclear so-called. And then the other song I picked was Distant Early Warning by Rush.
Ooh.
I don't know what album that's from.
What, are they in a hurry?
Yeah.
I mean, they're Canadians.
What are you running around for?
Fun fact about the dew line, though. There was a dew line that went right across the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
There were actually two other radar lines that went, like, one that went like all across Canada in the middle, and then one that went from like Nova Scotia to Vancouver along the border to essentially provide different levels of warning. So they'd be like, okay, they're 3 hours away. Now they're 2 hours away. So they spent a lot of times on radar stations.
Jeez. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I my uncle worked on one of those radar stations when he was stationed.
That's cool.
Cool. He was enlisted?
I don't know. I guess so. I guess you have to be enlisted to come in the military. This is like the 70s or whatever.
You just put an application and you're hired.
Yeah, it was really weird because he wasn't a Canadian citizen at the time, as far as I'm aware. And they're like, you're not Canadian? Okay, yeah, join the military anyway.
Yeah.
We don't care.
Canadian enough.
It's Cold War.
We can get.
Okay. So my pick for this one is actually, I don't know if either of us have picked a Caius song yet.
No, I don't think so.
And it's really just for one line in this song.
Okay.
But it's the song Green Machine.
Yeah.
Caius off of
Blues for the Red Sun.
Blues for the Red Sun, that's right. And it's for the one line, and I'm thinking about the conflict now between Leg and Burns.
Okay.
There's a line that goes, "Pretty please get the hell away from me."
Yeah,
and that's Seth what comes Burns. To mind. Yeah. Yeah, and here's how I'll do it.
I dare you. I dare you.
I'm not happy. No one.
Yeah. So Caius, I mean, I don't know what if I have to say much about Caius. They're awesome. Big inspiration for at least one band in this league.
Yeah.
And yeah, check that song out. It's pretty sweet.
Good album.
So that was a disaster, courtesy of Nuclear Norm. Mm-hmm. Might be back for another one this season. Who knows?
We hope.
Another one in the can. Maybe in a Tragedy Tuesday.
I've been sitting on this one since like August last year, basically. Oh,
okay.
No, because like I wrote it last year, right? And we just like took a hiatus break. So I was like, well, I went back to this and I had to relearn it after like
a
year.
That was awesome. Yeah, if you got any more on the that are ready,
you think I would have written more than one, but no, I didn't.
No, you just did the, you do one
I
at
just
a time.
Did this one and sat on it.
One at a time.
Plenty of time.
You got room in the chamber for one at a time. And now you got another one. But anyway, that was awesome. Thanks for listening. We're super happy to be doing this again. If you want to keep up with what we're doing, social media at This Disaster Pod, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can become a Patreon at patreon.com/thisdisasterpod. You can check everything out on our website, thisdisasterpod.com. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend to listen. That's the best.
Yeah.
You can also leave a rating or review wherever you listen. Spotify has them now, as well as Apple Podcasts. So just, leave us a review or send us a message. Send us a message. That's another one. You can send us a message, tell us to go fuck ourselves or that we're doing a good job or give us a suggestion for a disaster.
You can do that on the Discord channel too.
You know, you can't rate the podcast on Google Podcasts, which is what I use.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're the one person that listens on Google Podcasts.
Cool.
Everyone else is Apple and Spotify, it seems.
Oh, I joined my first Patreon last week.
Whoa, for what? Yeah,
for this show.
Oh.
It's great.
Really? Okay.
It's one of the skinny puppy guys.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of cool stuff.
They gotta feed that puppy.
They gotta feed that
puppy. Skinny for like 40 years.
He did a streaming video.
Yep.
Their first release was a demo that they did on 4-track.
Okay.
He had the master tapes.
Yeah.
And in between talking about, we did this song and showing. But he was doing a live mix on his 4-track.
Wow.
That's so cool.
That's awesome.
If you're a super fan like me, that's pretty great.
That's kind of the dream. I'm looking over at we have an 8-track reel-to-reel here. Mm-hmm. Tascam 388, I think it is. It'd be great to record something on that.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds so shitty, but it was so fun.
I did one album on a reel-to-reel 8-track.
Oh, wow. Okay.
With Topong.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Sounds like it.
Good. Good. What's it called? Is it on Bandcamp?
The band's called Lauderdale.
Oh, I remember that. You remember talking about that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, anyway, thanks for listening. That's pretty much all we had for this time, and we'll be back with more disasters.
We will.
So, bye.
Bye.
Bye.